The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning I wanted to speak about the place of love in our practice. There's often a wisdom emphasis to the teachings, the Buddhist teachings, the Eightfold Path, the path of practice that the Buddha offered begins with wise view, wise understanding, and wise intention, and that's it's oriented, seemingly oriented towards wisdom. The wise view, often expressed, the kind of the orientation that we take to practice, is expressed as understanding the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, that there is a cause of suffering, that cause of suffering is craving, holding. Clinging, including both holding on to things and pushing things away. And that it's possible to be free from that suffering, and that the path leading to the ending of suffering is the Eightfold Path, the path of wise understanding, wise intention, so a wisdom component, an ethical component, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, and a meditation or a mind training component, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And so on the surface of it, you know, wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, where's wise love? You know, so we might think it's not in there, but actually it's shot all the way through. And in a way we can look at the very understanding of the cause of suffering, that craving, as being the heart that is not open, a constricted heart, and that the freedom comes from the unconstricted heart. And so this is a way of framing the understanding of the Four Noble Truths. And it's about freeing the heart from the things, the ways that we keep it from loving. The resistance, the fear, the anxiety, the confusion, the wanting, the desire, the pride, the anger, the aversion. All of those things bury that possibility of love. And the understanding in the Buddhist teaching is that basically those constrictions of craving, of aversion, of confusion, of greed, are not inherent in our heart, but are visitors. They have been practiced. We have oriented and cultivated those in our hearts through habit, through habitual responses. And that as those begin to loosen, as we can find our way to loosening those grips, what is there is the heart that is unconstricted, and that heart is already in the terrain of love. So in a way, we can look at the path of practice as being one of more and more fully opening the heart to deeper and deeper love, unconditional love, not the love of romantic love, but the love of the unconstricted heart. Freedom. The freedom from suffering that's described in the Four Noble Truths, the third noble truth, that is possible to be free from suffering, is usually described as or I'd say the most common definition of that freedom is freedom from greed, aversion, and delusion. Again, those forces that constrict the heart. And so the freedom, as those forces release, the freeing from greed, aversion, and delusion creates a heart that is more connected to the world, that resonates with the world. It's an empathetic heart, really. That's one way to look at the heart of love. We can the qualities of love actually in the Buddhist teaching are spoken of all the time. They're deeply embedded in the teachings. And so there are four main qualities that are interrelated, I'd say. There's the quality of love itself, which is this open heart, this unconstricted heart. So we can look at it as open-heartedness, empathetic heart. Or we can look at it as the unconstricted heart, the heart that can resonate, respond to the world, rather than being defended and contracted, fearful, anxious. And so that's in a way, you know, the full flowering of love is that heart that is undefended. And yet in our path towards that, we have to recognize that our hearts are going to be defended. They are going to be fearful and anxious and confused, wanting to hold on to things, wanting to push things away. And part of our practice, and I was pointing to in the meditation, is opening to and allowing even that. That is the path towards the undefended heart, that we allow even the defendedness to be there. There's a saying in one of the texts of the Buddha, in the Dhammapada, hatred never ceases through hatred. Through love alone does it end. And we can look at that in terms of our relationships with others. In many ways, the Buddhist teaching is relational. This aspect of the undefended heart is a very relational teaching. And so that statement, hatred never ends through hatred, through love alone does it end, can be looked at as a relational teaching, but it can also be looked at as a personal teaching, a way of meeting our own experience. When we see hatred in our mind, hatred doesn't end through hating hatred in our minds. It begins to end through, not by, let's say, buying into that hatred, but by opening to, oh, this is the human experience of hatred. This is the human experience of confusion. This is the human experience of anger. Really a witnessing of ourselves at a very deep level. Witnessing, this is a human experience. This is the human experience of confusion. As we recognize that, there's a languaging that I explore around meeting our experience. I like to use the phrase, what does it mean to be with ourselves? What does it mean to be with our anger, our hatred, our pride, our greed? What does it mean to be with our confusion or boredom? That being with, when it's kind of surrounded by or infused with the quality of allowing, which to me is love, the allowing attitude of, oh, this is the human experience. So being with anger in the heart, with the recognition of, yeah, this is what anger feels like. It's a very different experience, a very different direction of the mind than being angry. So being with anger, with an allowing attitude, and being angry, very different things, very different directions in our heart. And the being with the allowing is that hatred not ceasing through hatred but through love. It moves the heart in the direction of recognizing, essentially we start to recognize with that allowing attitude around our reactive emotions, around our challenges, our difficulties, with that allowing attitude, that being with, our heart begins to understand this is not the way to well-being. This is not the way to an unconstricted heart. This is not the way to love. And so the heart itself begins to understand how to let go of that challenge, that reactivity. And so even right in the mindfulness practice, when we explore it with this allowing attitude, being with and allowing, creates the conditions for love. It is love. It's like our challenge is surrounded in a bigger container. It's held within a container of love and allowing and meeting. Compassion. So the quality of love is this quality of an open heart, an undefended heart. And as I said, we don't start with a fully undefended heart. There's a path that moves us in that direction, and that includes opening to what is defended. So that open heart, let's talk from the side of, you know, the possibility right now, with the possibility of having an undefended heart. From time to time, we may meet that. We may feel that. We may open to that quality of the heart that in moments or in certain situations can feel generous, kind, this wish for well-being for ourselves and others. This undefended heart, the heart that is this love, resonates, opens to, connects with both ourselves and others. It is not, it's not exclusive. it's unconditional in that it accepts and allows whatever is here to be here, but it's also not stupid. It's not that it accepts and allows whatever's here to be here and wishes for it if something is unskillful happening or something unjust happening. It doesn't just stand there and wish for it to continue. It understands, this undefended heart understands that what has come to be here and now is here. It's undefended about what is already here and is also, there's a component of wisdom, of understanding that recognizes, yes, this is what's here, and this heart wishes to take action to alleviate confusion and suffering in the world. And so this is where this heart is not just a passive experience. The heart, the undefended heart, the heart of love is not a passive heart. It's very active. And when it meets suffering in the world, that heart of love responds with compassion. Compassion being the heart that is unconstricted when it sees suffering. The heart that, again, there's a kind of the empathetic response. the heart that doesn't shut down, either out of fear or confusion or not wanting to see the suffering, or the heart that shuts down out of anger and hatred around the suffering, but the heart that is, oh, this is suffering that's happening in the world. This heart can be open to it. And that heart of compassion wants to act. It's not a passive emotion. There was a study done by some scientists. I believe it was done by Richie Davidson, where they had some monks who had cultivated compassion to a very high degree, and they could, in meditation, put themselves into a state of compassion. I think, I mean, the way one engages or puts oneself into a state of compassion is by opening the heart and then bringing to mind the suffering that's happening in the world. Now, actually consciously bringing the suffering into your mind. This is what turns that heart of love into compassion, when it actively meets struggle and suffering. And so these monks, who are very highly skilled at cultivating and opening to compassion, were put into an MRI machine, I believe. And as they discovered that in their brains, not only was the part of the mind that was associated with wholesome qualities active, but also the part of the mind that wanted to act was active, that wanted to do something. And so this quality of compassion wants to engage, to alleviate suffering. We often think when we're, you know, angry about an injustice in the world, that why would I, you know, if I weren't angry, why would I do anything? And this emotion of compassion is the why we would engage, why we would do something, even if anger were absent. It is possible to meet suffering and meet injustice in the world without anger, with compassion not only for the person suffering, for ourselves, but also for the perpetrator of that action. Recognizing, you know, as we watch our own minds, you know, we see turning inward, we recognize hatred exists in this heart, anger exists in this heart, confusion exists in this heart. When I really saw this for the first time, it was humbling, but also very, in a way, I don't know, the mind expressed it in this way of like, oh my gosh, this isn't just my heart that's like this. It's everybody's heart. No wonder there is so much pain and suffering in the world. No wonder there is war in the world. And so there's that recognition that this heart too has that that possibility of anger, of confusion, of hatred. So we look into our own hearts, opening to the release of that, and we attempt in our actions to act from the place of compassion rather than from the place of anger. And so this is a challenge for us. This is not an easy task. And so this heart of metta, this open heart, this unconstricted heart, meets suffering and resonates with it, with this compassion and this desire to act out of compassion. And it also meets joy. It meets, when that heart is recalling or bringing to mind or meeting the joys of life, because our lives are not just about suffering. There are so many beautiful things happening. Every day, there are children being born into families that there's so much happiness and joy and love. And every day, there are people dying and so much pain and suffering. It is the, as it's said, I think, in the Zen, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And so this heart that is unconstricted opens to both. It resonates with both. So there's the heart that, the unconstricted heart itself is the heart of love. When that unconstricted heart meets suffering, it's the heart of compassion. When that unconstricted heart meets joy, it resonates in sympathy with the quality called sympathetic joy, mudita in the Pali. And then there is the quality of equanimity, which balances the heart that is meeting the joys and the sorrows. The quality of equanimity, which is the deepening of the capacity for us to actually meet both the joys and the sorrows, to actually open. And that equanimity is an expression of wisdom. That equanimity, again, not necessarily being just settling back, oh, it's like this, you know, things, this is the way it is, and so, you know, I'm okay with that. That's not what equanimity is. Equanimity recognizes and understands it's like this, the conditions have created this here now. There is suffering here. There is the 10,000 sorrows, the 10,000 joys. That heart of equanimity can hold both and wants to act. It's not stupid about what leads to suffering in our world. So equanimity is the quality that allows us to not be buffeted around by the joys and the sorrows. What allows our heart to really fully open and be unconstricted. And so we're kind of back to wisdom again. And to me, it does feel that, you know, we cultivate love. There's many different ways to cultivate this open heart. And I'll talk about some of those in a moment. But first of all, recognizing that, you know, the value of the open heart, the unconstricted heart being not one that is just passive, but is active in the world. And so we begin to practice with that. We recognize that our hearts are not fully open. We see those places where it's not able to open. And open to the possibility, as we talked about at the beginning, of allowing and being with that. That's how equanimity is cultivated. We open to and allow our own constrictions. In that opening, allowing to our own constrictions, we recognize the impersonal nature of it and how it is repeating itself 7 billion times over. And that heart of equanimity begins to understand and recognize, yeah, it's not just here. It's not just about me. And that equanimity begins to allow the heart to more fully release. And so the full, at least my understanding is the full opening to that heart of compassion, of love, comes with understanding. That these two qualities of love and understanding are intimately connected. If we can approach it from the perspective of cultivating the understanding, and we'll work our way around to love. We can cultivate it from the perspective of exploring, how can I open my heart? How can I more fully be willing to be here with what this to love what's here? How can I more fully allow this? We open from the direction of love, and we come around to understanding. They both join wisdom and love. Or understanding. I like understanding because it's got a more active quality to it. Understanding and loving, they come together. And so with any quality that we are exploring, cultivating, any beautiful quality, and there's so many beautiful qualities that the practice encourages for us, love, compassion, joy, equanimity, these four that we are exploring today, generosity, non-harming, the heart, again, these are based in so many ways in this heart of love, that when we have a heart that is unconstricted, our heart doesn't wish to harm. And so non-harming is another expression of love. And we can cultivate non-harming actively, that having a kind of an impact or a rebound effect on our hearts. Other beautiful qualities, patience, truthfulness. Tranquility, mindfulness itself, when it's explored with this allowing, receptive quality. And so as we explore cultivating love, this open heart, this unconstricted heart, there's kind of, two basic ways we can go about it. We can cultivate it actively, coming at it from the direction of love itself. Or we can kind of come at it from the direction of what's in the way, what's keeping love from the heart. And so from the more active side, we can cultivate the open heart. Again, in different ways, there's the formal practice that we offer in this tradition of actively cultivating love through orienting the mind to thinking thoughts of goodwill for ourselves and for others. And so, recognizing this needs to be done in a way that we recognize that our heart isn't quite there yet, perhaps, but that we are exploring the possibility, we're expressing the intention. This is the direction I'd like the heart to go. I'd like it to be able to wish well to myself and others. And again, it's not just about others, it's to ourselves too. This is clear in the Buddhist teaching that we cultivate these qualities for ourselves as well as for others. And in so many ways, I think, again, the full flowering of love needs both. Needs for us to have both that open heart for ourselves and for others. And so there's this active cultivation of the practice of metta through cultivating, thinking thoughts of goodwill. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be safe. May I be at ease. And recognizing that it's not like an affirmation of I am happy, I am healthy. It's expressing a wish. It's expressing an intention. And so it's not fighting with our hearts if our hearts are feeling a little constricted or even a lot constricted. Maybe there's the possibility of recognizing that and wishing for, expressing the wish, may there be more ease here. May there be more well-being here. So it's about that intention, this practice of metta. And there are similar practices for compassion and sympathetic joy, where we express wishes. May you be free from suffering, the basic compassion wish. May your joy and success continue, the basic joy wish for others. And so there are these kind of formal practices that we can explore to incline the heart in that direction, to open the heart in that direction, even as we recognize not quite fully there yet. And then there's also the possibility of recognizing when it naturally arises, because it does. You know, sometimes we miss it when our heart does feel undefended. You know, sometimes we miss it because we're doing something else or focused on accomplishing something perhaps. And so there may be moments of appreciation and joy and delight and open-heartedness or that sense of compassion. And so recognizing them when they come, recognizing them when they arise, that undefended heart. This is another way to cultivate it, basically using mindfulness. Oh, this, we talked earlier about being with anger. We can also be with love. Oh, this is the human experience of love. This is the human experience of compassion. This is the human experience of joy. This is the human experience of generosity. I talked about how that being with difficult states of mind, that allowing attitude, oh, this is the human experience of anger, is very different from being angry, because it creates the conditions for that, the heart to begin to understand this is not the direction that towards well-being. As we open with that heart of allowing towards anger, being with anger rather than being angry, as we open with that heart of allowing, the heart feels the pain of that anger. It understands directly in the moment, right then and there, this is not well-being. This is not the way towards well-being. And so that quality of mindfulness supports the heart to let go of those painful, reactive emotions. And that very same quality of being with love, of being with compassion when they arise. The heart sings when it recognizes that. It recognizes, this is the way to well-being. This is the human experience of love. This is the human experience of compassion. This undefended heart. This is the way. And so that very same recognition, that allowing, moves us, whether we're exploring or looking at anger or love, it moves us in the same direction, towards more love, more compassion, more joy. Sometimes as we practice even meeting our difficult states of mind, you know, exploring being with, I've explored so many negative states of mind in my practice. That as we're willing to be with our fear, our depression, our anxiety, willing to hold it without allowing, not trying to repress it, not trying to fight it. But again, it's like a bigger container of allowing that has love in that allowing, holding the challenge. Very often, it seems to me, that as we allow that, whatever that is in the middle, anger or depression or fear or confusion, As we allow that, and it begins to soften, because it does, if we are able to hold it, sometimes as it releases, we see that there's a connection between whatever that challenge is and the heart that wants to be happy, wants to be free, wants to be well, wants to be safe. And a very clear demonstration of this at one point when I was experiencing fear, a lot of fear. For me, a lot of fear. I don't have that many occasions to experience fear. And so it was a strong fear in my experience, but it's, you know, in the big scope of things, probably not that big. But I was, it was after the September 11th attacks, and I flew the second day. I had to fly. I had been visiting my family, and I needed to fly home. And the second day after the plane started again, I was on the plane. And I was diverted through, or actually I took a flight through Houston where there was bad weather, and so I didn't make my connection. So I had to spend the night at the airport in Houston. And in the middle of the night, there was a power outage. And my mind went to terrorist attack. Clearly, you know, jumping to conclusions, but at the same time, you know, my mind, I was staying at George Bush International Airport, and my mind thought, well, what better statement, you know, for a terrorist attack? These were conditions in my mind, you know, and so the power outage went on for a long time, and so there was I had a lot of time to watch the fear. You know, when I looked out my window, it wasn't just the hotel, it was everywhere. So it was a broad power outage. And it lasted, I don't know how long it lasted, because I did finally fall asleep, but I felt a lot of fear, huge amount of fear, and so my practice was right there to be with the fear. And I began also exploring the metta practice. May all beings be safe, may all beings be happy, may all beings be well. And as I connected to that phrase, may all beings be safe, my heart just landed. It's like, yes, that's what I want. I want all beings to be safe. And when I lost touch of that, the heart would go into fear. And I could directly see this deep connection between this wish for safety, which is the wish for metta, and the heart that was unable to hold that wish with equanimity, when the heart could not hold that wish for safety for all beings with equanimity, fear just came pouring in. And yet the fear and the metta, because when I could touch into that wish, oh, may all beings be safe, it was one of the more powerful experiences of metta that I had had to that time. And I could see that the depth of the fear and the depth of the metta were connected. They came to that same root of wishing for safety and well-being for all beings. And it was the heart that was reactive, not able to hold that. Yes, this is the wish, and the truth is maybe all beings are not going to be safe. So the heart of equanimity can hold both without feeling like the wish is invalid, or feeling like the truth of maybe all beings aren't going to be safe because impermanent, unreliable, this is a truth of our experience. This is a truth of the world. And so the heart of equanimity can hold both of those, can hold both that wish of love and compassion and kindness and the understanding that experience is unreliable. You know, so often those two, the unreliable nature of experience and the wish for well-being and happiness and safety, collide. and we feel like, well, either one or the other has got to be wrong. Either it's wrong, it's not true that things are unreliable and I've got to find a way to make them reliable, or this wish for my own well-being, my safety, the wish for safety and happiness and well-being for all beings is not a valid wish. And yet both can be held with this heart of love and equanimity. And that's what I touched into there. You know, that when we meet what's in the middle, when we meet anger, you know, often anger is a result of wanting our own well-being or wanting the well-being of others. And it, again, meeting that kind of the realities of the world and not being able to hold both. Recognizing, too, that the heart that can hold both is not one that's passive, but is active. Will attempt to do what it can to alleviate suffering. And so often when we open to explore being with our challenging reactive states of mind, with that allowing attitude, what I've seen so many times that I've begun to think that there's a real connection there is that as the heart can open to that, it lands in love. Because I think so many of our reactive emotions, if not all of our reactive emotions, come down to the inability to hold both of these truths, these wishes for our well-being and the truths of the reality of impermanent, unreliable, out of control nature of our lives. And as those two can be held, we land in both the truth and the love. Again, wisdom and compassion, wisdom and love, the heart opening to meet both. So I'm curious what your thoughts on this topic are. Yeah, and would you use the mic?
So I find this a very difficult topic. And I think I was reading that book, The Buddha's Brain or The Buddha's Mind, one that's being discussed, and it talks about waking up in the morning and you're either going to feed the heart of love or feed the heart of hate. And I really liked everything you had to say because it just, you know, leaving yourself open to look at what's really going on.
Yeah.
And there's one comment they made about, this writer made about sometimes having a trigger for hate. You know, and maybe there's danger. And that can be instructive.
Yeah.
So that's helpful to me. I mean, I just...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our system is designed to orient towards, you know, that a lot of times when we feel anger or fear, you know, it's a warning sign. And so, you know, we need to have some wisdom around that. And what in my own experience, this allowing of meeting those states, you know, begins to point out, it's like it begins to reveal the wisdom in there or the extra, you know, because, you know, so much of our fear and our reactivity is built on thoughts and ideas and not on the actual reality. And so the exploration of, oh, what is this fear? What is this hate? Begins to tease apart. You know, and yet, you know, we can't wait, you know. It's like we can't wait until we have a pure, clear understanding necessarily. We do the best we can. And yet, whatever wisdom, whatever mindfulness we can bring to that situation will support us in moving in the direction of non-hate. So it's a practice. It's an exploration. We are not going to be able to, you know, flip the switch and say, "Oh, there's hatred. That's not useful. Let me stop that." You know, we see it in our hearts, and it's like, you know, how do I deal with this? And having hatred to hatred is not the way either. You know, so that's this practice of allowing. And yet we may have to act on it. We may have to act on it because our hearts are in training. They're in training. They've still got the training wheels on. And, you know, it's like, yeah, I don't have time to fully, you know, free the heart from the constricted side of this before I decide that this is not a safe situation and I need to get out of here. You know, it's like we may have to act on that. And yet, at least being aware, you know, when we can be aware, yes, oh, you know, I'm acting on this fear. When we can be aware of that, it supports us. And when we can be aware later, wow, I acted on that fear. Oh, okay, what's happening now? What's happening now around that? So, yeah, we do. But I do see that, you know, at least in my own experience, this willingness to meet these difficulties, it's like very slow. It's like turning a battleship, you know. It turns the mind in the direction of more and more love. But we aren't going to be able to wake up in the morning and just say, okay, only love today. So there's got to be a way to meet that part of ourselves which is not loving with some love. And that's what I'm exploring. Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes it seems to me that there's like a societal pressure for this zero sum game. If I'm going to be willing to let love into my life, then somewhere along the line there's going to be something that comes crashing down to balance it out. I don't know. It's kind of, you see it played out in the political arena where it's either like, well, if you're going to be a bleeding heart liberal and give all this money to all of these teachers and schools and my God, infrastructure, you know, then everything's going to fall apart, and so it's like it's not safe in some context to bring up a discourse about love, because then it's like you're waiting to get slapped down for having an opinion about how we need to care for each other. And I've gotten into trouble in family discussions where, well, all you need to say is family discussions, and I don't need to finish the sentence. But, you know, it's kind of like I don't even want to express myself sometimes to them because they just... like, you know, what do you mean you meditate? You know, so anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there because it's sometimes it's hard to meet up with the outside influences that would have you feel like somebody less than because you are caring about the little furry creatures or something.
Yeah, I definitely relate to this. You know, I when I first started practicing metta, I realized that I had an attitude about love as being a zero-sum game. You know, that if I was happy, it meant somebody else was unhappy. If somebody else was happy, it meant I was unhappy. You know, it's like it's not only in my own life, but in relationship to the world. And I think that comes partly because we relate happiness to material things. You know, and there's only a certain number of material things. And so, yes, you know, somebody has more, somebody has less in terms of you know, material goods. We are a finite planet here. So, you know, we have only a certain amount of material goods. So if we are equating happiness with that, then that's how our minds will work. And so the exploration around love is not around, it's around looking at the possibility for happiness, a different kind of happiness, not the happiness around having things. And so that's one piece of it, is that we begin to recognize that, you know, actually as we, you know, and this was kind of mind-blowing for me at one point when I saw a friend of mine really, you know, things were going very well for her in that particular moment. And I saw her, and I was very mindful. We were on retreat together, and I saw her, and my heart just opened. And it's like, I'm so glad that things are going well for you. And it's like, wow, her happiness made me happy. That was like, this is not a zero-sum game. This is a multiplier, you know. And the Dalai Lama actually expresses this. He says, you know, it's good to take joy in the happiness of others, because then your chances of happiness are increased now 7 billion to 1. So there's that side of it, that piece of it, around this is a different kind of happiness we're exploring. And so that's something to look at in our own hearts. And I spent a long time looking at that piece, that feeling of needing to defend my turf, needing to defend the happiness that I had, needing to hold on to it. It's not okay to share, you know, that kind of feeling, watching that, seeing that, seeing how that actually constricted the happiness that was there, that feeling. And then the other side of your question around, you know, having conversations with people, and you know, it's we need to have some wisdom around, you know, where who we speak to, how we speak to people. At this point, I feel pretty confident that whatever my own sense of well-being, it's not going to be reliant on somebody telling me I'm stupid for thinking these things, you know. So, and yet I know I went through times where I needed to be very careful about who I spoke to, because the growing seed of love was so fragile that it needed protection. So, and I saw it in my own mind. I mean, at one point, I was experiencing one of those times where I talked about, you know, opening to something challenging, opening to depression. And the depression had gotten very big, but it was like, oh yeah, allow it, allow it. And the allowing got really, really big, and the depression got really, really big, and suddenly the whole thing was love. It was like, wow, whew, expansive, beautiful, heart of love. And then the very next moment, the mind said, this is stupid, this is sappy. And so my own mind, you know, not really being able to hold that beautiful quality of love. And it's like, okay, I have more work to do. You know, I didn't beat myself up around it. It's like, wow, even in this own heart, there's that belief that somehow this is stupid, you know? And so, you know, so we do have to take care of our, and look in our own hearts for that tendency, and protect that little flower. Yeah, there's just a minute, so.
Okay. My feeling about the family argument, I mean, first of all, I've been kind of lucky because there are significant differences of opinion within my extended family, none within my immediate nuclear family, so, you know, got a certain barrier. But I think if you get if you flare up about something that you really feel passionate about, which there's a legitimate reason to flare up, that can start then spreading the things where you indulging and flaring up, and things where you don't really have such a good reason to flare up. And so to just containing the spirit of argumentativeness, maybe the best practice is to be careful about not flaring up even when you have a good reason.
Well, and again, there's ways what we can also practice is not being angry. I mean, you know, yes, there are times where we're not going to be able to not be angry. And yet, you know, there can also be the passion of love. You know, so I am starting to talk about my sense that, you know, Donald Trump is not a candidate that I want in the White House, that he is spreading hatred, and hatred never ceases through hatred. And so this is not what I want in our culture. And so I've been able to speak to that without the anger.
Yeah, he's spreading both hatred and falsehood, I think. Okay. Occasionally hatred is based on truth, but not his.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, and I think that's one thing Gil actually points to. It's like, you know, if you're angry and you're right, it's like gasoline in a match.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, it's a dangerous combination, right. And so that's a particular place to be careful.
You're talking about not having hatred for hatred, but maybe allowing yourself to experience that. I was thinking of the late Seinfeld episode where George Costanza's father is trying to practice serenity, and when he gets in a tight situation, he yells with a loud, angry voice, "Serenity now!"
Yeah, that's the way that we tend to. Yeah. So we need to stop. Thank you.